The impression successfully created by Joseph Goebbels, with a little help from the film industry, was that the German population were in complete support of the Führer. But Katrine Clay, in her new book, The Good Germans, points out that there was significant and courageous opposition to the Nazis and their reign of terror. And this resistance was greater than was ever formally recorded. Some took a brave, principled and prominent stand, but many ordinary people did what they could in small and calculated ways. So to tell the story of some of the Germans who resisted, we're joined by Katrine Clay, who's worked for the Beeb for over 20 years, directing and producing any number of award-winning television documentaries. Welcome to our little program, Katrine.
Thank you very much.
Let's start in the early 30s. Hitler persuades enough people to vote for him to enable his party to enter parliament.
No, he doesn't. He never had a majority. The only way he became chancellor was with a coalition with the other right-wing parties. And that happened because they were so scared of the communists and the socialists.
Yes, I know that. I'm well aware that two-thirds didn't support him.
But he didn't actually have enough people. He had to take over by other undercover means, you might say, but he did. And once power is in the wrong hands, you have had it, actually. That was one of the conclusions I came to writing this book, is that if you're a small, you know, an ordinary little person, you know, teacher or whatever, and this happens, you can't do much about it.
Once Hitler was able to gain a foothold in power, he begins the reign of terror. What does a culture of fear and intimidation do to a population?
Well, you know, this is another thing I sort of came to understand, because, you know, you in Australia and we in England, I guess you can say we're extremely lucky. We've never had to experience such a thing. But, you know, once it happens, I thought you just got frightened. I never understood until one of my characters actually explained it to me, so to speak, from the past, that it's a political tool. It's a very deliberate, unbelievably effective political tool to scare people, well, in this case, literally to death. You know, they'll fall in. The vast majority, as you rightly say in your introduction, two-thirds of Germans never voted for the Nazis and were then suddenly subjected to what was immediately and overnight a terror regime. Most of them, you know, what do you do? You keep your head down. You try, maybe you move. I don't know what you do to try and protect yourself.
Well, you see people fearful of being denounced, losing their jobs, their homes, and yes, leading to imprisonment, torture, death. So yeah, they were impervious to the Goebbels Riefenstahl sort of reign of image making.
No, I don't think that's true. I think Goebbels and Riefenstahl were absolutely brilliant at their job. And I think, although it's dangerous to make comparisons from now to then, way back when, I think one comparison you can make is fake news. And I think Goebbels was absolutely brilliant at it. So these newsreels that, as you mentioned in your introduction, the general population saw, showed, you know, what looked like millions of people, absolutely hysterical, shouting Sieg Heil in the streets as Hitler went by in his Mercedes, you know. And you need to just look at the numbers. And even if there were a million out in the streets on that occasion when they were being filmed, you know, even if there were a million, which there certainly weren't, the population was 67 million, you know. However, of those 67 million, pretty much all of them went to the cinema. There was no television, obviously, in those days. And they went and they watched the newsreels. I imagine a lot of them were as duped by this as apparently we went on being duped for years after the war. As you say, we looked at those archive newsreels and we thought, my God, you know, those Germans, they really are, you know, they were absolutely goners. And it's just not true.
Let's look at a couple of the great dissenters. Tell us about Julius Leber.
Ah, Julius Leber. Julius Leber was one of those people who you might call larger than life. He was one of the great social democrats in the Reichstag. And, you know, he would stand up in the Reichstag and fight anyone. He was fantastically eloquent, charismatic, as we sort of say, big man, clothes awry, old hat jammed on his head, you know, a real big character. And you know, he got into not just verbal fights, he got into physical fights, because you have to understand, up until January 1933, Germany was virtually in civil war, and he was a normal social democrat, but an absolutely dedicated one. And he saw what was happening with these fascists, and he really did. I mean, he was out in the streets shouting against them, fighting them. So what's the net result for him? Which he knew, of course, the moment the Nazis had what they called the Machtergreifung, which means the seizing of power, he knew what would happen. He was arrested. I mean, almost immediately, he was rounded up, along with hundreds and thousands of other people, all socialists, social democrats, or communists, and into prison he went. And initially, they didn't have proper concentration camps. They were building them like mad, you know, to keep up. And if you care to look at a map of concentration camps at the end of the war, you'll see the whole of Poland and some of Germany just dotted with little black dots of concentration camps everywhere. Anyway, by the time he went in, which was very early on, it was first of all a Gestapo prison, solitary. And then later on, concentration camp. And then, you know, you have to understand, if you don't know about brutality, you know, we don't, do we? We don't live with it day in, day out. We just don't have the imagination to understand the kinds of things they do, let's call them the really depraved lot, did. And to him, in Esterwegen concentration camp, they were made, Dahrendorf tells us this, who was a very, very reliable source, and he was there too. They were made by the sort of runt of the SS, I suppose you could say. They were made to build little buildings out of human shit. So that's already unbelievably extraordinary. You know, for hours a day, they were told to pick it up, make it into little brick things. And then they told Herr Dr. Leber, Julius Leber, he was to take some of this shit and eat it. I mean, you just can't imagine these things happening. But of course they do. They do. And it's our failure not to understand that once a brutal regime takes over, they do unimaginable things.
He remains defiant despite torture, imprisonment, and he's hanged in February 1949 as the Allies are crossing the Rhine. There's a terrible irony in that.
Yeah, well, it's not an irony, it's deliberate. Do you see what I mean? They let him out thinking, in 35, they let him out. So that's 2 years later. And they thought, after all that, we're not going to have any more trouble from Herr Dr. Leber. And Leber had a wife, who is a great character in my book, and two children, teenage. So, he goes back to Lübeck, his hometown, where he is a hero to two-thirds of the population and an enemy to the rest. And he keeps his head down very cleverly for a whole year, apart from anything else, he has to recover physically. But he keeps on having his quiet meetings in, you know, all that stuff that people do not to be spotted. But for the first year, he really does do almost nothing. And then he gets going again. And he really doesn't stop until he's arrested again.
There's a very inspiring communist leader, Ernst Thälmann.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Telemann had an even worse fate because, they were both killed in the end. And they were both killed, as you say, in the very last weeks of the war as revenge. Do you see what I mean? It wasn't by chance. They were kept alive and tortured for years in order to have revenge, and with always the intention of killing them in the end. And literally, I mean, you know, Berlin was falling. The Russians were there. Ernst Thälmann was the leader of the German communists. And I always think it's rather important to make a distinction between Russian communists and so on, you know. Leader of the German. He was immensely charismatic, very, very powerful, and of course had millions of voters. I mean, the last proper elections were November 1932, and between him and the Social Democrats, they had 3 or 4 million more votes than any of the the Nazis or anyone. You know, they huge support. Inevitably, as soon as they possibly could, they arrested him. And what they did was they did a put-up job, which they were doing all the time. Another example of fake news, of the Reichstag fire. Obviously, they blamed a communist, 3 communists, and obviously they hadn't done it. It had been the Nazis themselves. And afterwards, they said, right now, this is a terrible thing these communists have done, typical. We are going to round up 10,000 of them and, you know, stick them in prison. Thälmann had already actually been stuck inside, in fact, by then. They kept him in solitary. If you can try and imagine this, in a cell, in solitary, for 11 and a half years. I mean, it's completely unbelievable. Occasionally they moved him. When they thought, there was something going on or something, they'd move him to somewhere else. But it was always in solitary. It was for 11 and a half years. And at the end of it, they executed him.
We should also point out that there were still quite a few communists in the factories where they were busily sabotaging. And I think you've discovered more of that than I had ever understood.
I discovered more of it than I'd ever understood, because you have to understand, my father was typical of any Englishman or Australian, for that matter, who'd been in the war, and he did 5 years in the war. And I grew up with him saying, you know, it's the Germans generally, you know, something completely wrong with the Germans. And it wasn't until much later that I realized not only were 2/3 never Nazis and had to put up with the terror regime and the war, incidentally, which was always the plan, but they went on fighting, sabotage, loads of communists, loads of social democrats, totally anonymous, loads of them, I mean hundreds of thousands, were in sabotage rings. And the reason we know this for a fact, if you look into it, there are a couple of books written about it, which are chapter and verse. The reason is because they never outdid, contrary to myth, they never outdid the armaments trade in England or anywhere else. They were always behind the Germans, always, because they couldn't get their workforce to work fast, efficiently, and without sabotage. Whereas our lot, us, we were all one voice, everyone fighting and trying to produce this these weapons.
You also give us accounts of more ordinary and unassuming Germans who helped Jews and others targeted by the Nazis to escape. And we've just got time for one such person, the woman that ran a bakery.
Yes, Tante Ney. Tante means aunt. Düsseldorf suburbs. Her and her husband ran a local bakery on the corner, a family called Engelmann. I mean, what I do is I try and tell the big stories of history through 6 small personal stories. And one of them is Bernd Engelmann, who is a schoolboy of 12. And his parents are with the Neys, the bakers, in a ring, getting Jews out, because Düsseldorf's not far from the border with Holland. And in the same ring, there is a pastor and a teacher. And oddly enough, a man, Bernd, the schoolboy, hates, who is his father's very smart tailor, who's in the SS. And Ben thinks, God, what, why does my father still go to this ghastly tailor? One day he has to go to the tailor's, pick up a suit for his father. And in the back room, he sees hidden a whole family of Jews. Turns out that Fishface, as Ben likes to call him, although in the SS, was actually a Quaker. And he got out hundreds and hundreds of people, along with this very local, totally anonymous network of people in the suburbs of Düsseldorf. And no one's ever heard of them, you know. So I was very, very pleased to be able to include that as one of my six stories.
You make the point that it wasn't until 1980 that Germany created a memorial to those who resisted the Nazis.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, isn't that amazing? And it's an amazingly interesting, moving place to go and visit, incidentally, in Berlin, which people should do if they're in Germany. But the other thing you might remember is that it wasn't until probably the 1960s that anyone was prepared to admit that there were any resistors who were communists or social democrats. We knew about the aristocrats, which were massively courageous and did the July 20th plot. But we didn't know about the communists because we were not meant to have any communist heroes. Do you see? So that was another thing we discovered.
We were meant, of course, to know about the heroic military officers who attempted on a number of occasions to kill Hitler. But you're right, the communists had to be, in a sense, written out of history.
Well, they were. Actually, frankly, they were. And there aren't any books written until quite late on in the 60s, really, about that. And they were by far the biggest, of course. Though in the end, it was the army officers who had to try and actually assassinate Hitler because they were the only ones who could gain access to him. He had a triple ring of SS around him wherever he went. He hardly went out anywhere. He was virtually a drug addict by the end. The story is so utterly different to the way it's normally passed down in history, even now. I suppose that was the pleasure of writing the book, really.
Well, you've done a great job, Katrine. I really will there be a televisual version, given your credentials as a doco maker?
Well, I tell you, there is a television producer who says they want to buy the rights, so that would be nice. And it's Book of the Week here on the BBC radio in a couple of weeks' time. I hope very much people will listen because my book came out with 600 other books on what's called Super Thursday. Can you imagine that? So how are you going to get attention other than if nice people like you interview me?
Well, it's a pleasure to do so, Katrine. And I thank you very much. Katrine's new book is The Good Germans, Resisting the Nazi, 1933 to 1945, available in Australia through Hachette.